This is Soundings editor Walt Beam. Soundings enthusiasts have been for some time promised an issue on the subject of mini computers. Finally, your editor was able to get the right combination, and here it is. The main feature of this edition is a visit to what might be called the birthplace of the mini computer, the plant of Digital Equipment Corporation in Maynard, Massachusetts. There, in a huge old woolens mill, which Digital began to occupy early in its corporate career, most hardware and software development still takes place. Our interview with Kenneth H. Olson, a founder and the president of Digital, took place in his office, where we were joined by several of his colleagues. Ken, what did you see as the start of the minicomputer era?
I feel that Whirlwind was the first minicomputer. It wasn't mini in size. It was 2,500 square feet, and the racks were 10 or 11 feet high, and you walk into the room, it's like walking into a telephone switching central. By all definitions, it was a minicomputer, except in size. Whirlwind was, first of all, designed to be accessible, readily used. You could interchange directly with it as a user. And secondly, it tied easily to an application. It was designed originally to control aircraft or simulate aircraft. By the time it was finished, World War II was well over, and many applications were worked on. And the final one was air defense. And it was designed and really started the idea of making a computer readily tied to control many different applications. The characteristics of Whirlwind read very much like the specification of a modern computer. It had A to D converters. It had cathode ray displays with joystick and with light pen. It had half-inch magnetic tape. It had drums. Many computers are hard to define. And this is the only area I can think of making a reasonable definition. For a long time, I fought against the word because it was so hard to define. But I think a machine that's easy to tie to and a machine that's easy to work with, and then nowadays, we, of course, in low price and normally small size are some of the characteristics.
How did DEC get into the minicomputer business?
Well, we were at MIT where we worked on Whirlwind and then made the TX-0 and got the TX-2 transistor computer started. Before that, we had worked on the SAGE system, which was a monstrous system. After that, we made a couple of transistorized computers. We wrote papers and presented them at IEEE. And the industry smiled at us because we were academic people. And it was the motivation to show them that really was the big motivation to go into business. And so we proposed going into a computer business. We went to American Research and Development Corporation and asked for financing. And the staff gave us three bits of advice before we went to their board of directors. One was don't use the word computer because Fortune magazine said no one was making money and there was little likelihood they ever would make money with computers. So we said we were going to make printed circuit boards. And they said 5% profit that we had promised to make really wasn't enough to worth the gamble, so we promised to make 10%. And they said promise quick results because most of the board of directors were over 80. So we promised quick results. Interestingly, we did these things, and we never would have done them if we didn't try. So we started off making printed circuit boards and then worked toward a computer. When we had all the modules we needed, we assembled them into a computer.
What was the first computer that you assembled out of your modules at Digital Equipment?
The first computer was our PDP-1. This we charged $120,000 for. And we had a terrible time selling it because computers then cost $2-3 million, and no one wanted to buy a computer. They didn't believe it would work at $120,000. But we sold 70 or 80 of them, and that got us started in the computer business. PDP-1 was, at the time, a reasonably powerful machine and had a number of features in it that made it very convenient for use. And a year or two after we got that started, we got a request to bid from Chalk River Atomic Energy Facility in Canada. They wanted a device to do a special control application in a atomic power pile being experimented with for atomic power. And we said in our reply that we had no one who had enough interest or enough time or enthusiasm to put together that much digital logic and be sure it would work. It was just so tedious. But we said we'd make a special computer for them and charge them as if it was a production item. It would be the bare minimum computer, and we were sure it would do their job, and we called it the PDB-5. And we bid this, and they were very happy with it because they had written specifications for their hardware device, but they didn't really understand what they wanted. With a computer, they could change their mind as they learned. So we made the first one, shipped it to them, they were happy, and that started off the truly small mini computer.
Was the PDP-5 essentially compatible with the later PDP-8s, 12-bit words and this sort of thing?
Oh, yes. We charged $29,000 for the PDP-5 and immediately started work on the next generation. The idea we had when we started the company was that the world needed large numbers of computers to do all those control applications, that almost everything that needed control really needed a computer. In order to really influence things, we knew we had to make them in large numbers. So the PDP-8, we decided to study all the techniques of the appliance manufacturers. We studied dryers and washers and dishwashers, manufacturing and assembly techniques. So the PDP-8, we made the closest we could to appliance and still keep the reliability we wanted. This machine we came up with for about $18,000, and this really started off the PDP-8. And then we started working on new ones continuously, and the then went to 12 and 8. Now we sell them for $4,000 and $5,000.
What kind of sales growth did DEC have at the time you began computer building?
Oh, we are probably only $200,000 or $300,000 on.
Today?
We finished last year at about $187 million, and we're well on $200 million a year now. There's another very significant bit of history, and at least from my point of view, that happened at MIT. Well, we were at Lincoln Laboratory. We gave the TX0 computer to the educational part of MIT. And a couple years later, We Digital gave a PDP-1. And together, those machines were left open for the students to use as they please. At the time of the TX0 went down, people at MIT had a very large IBM installation. They believed that all you ever needed was Fortran, and that no one ever needed faster response than to leave the problem in the slot one day and pick up the answer the next. And there was quite negative reaction to installing a computer that was open to students. But these two computers sitting there at MIT, I think, are the biggest factor in the development of mini computers and time sharing and the whole concept of interacting computing. The students could sign up for it anytime during the 24-hour day. For several weeks ahead, the machines were constantly run, and those hundreds or thousands of students going out into the world really are what changed the world. When things became too crowded, they added time sharing, and from that came the time sharing we now see.
Your present product line has broadened considerably. Could you give us, in a few words, a view as to just how broad that product line is?
PDP-8 is still one of our largest selling machines. We have three versions of the same machine. We call it 8M, 8F, and 8E, and they're varying in size, and then the peripherals to go with them. Then one step below that, we have two machines we call our PDP-14 and 16, which are usually our true computers, but they're limited and used largely as dedicated controllers to control specific operations, and they're therefore less expensive. And then our 16-bit computer line is a whole family. It starts with a 1105, 1110, 1115, 1120, 1140, and then the 1145, which is a quite large, some people call a MIDI computer. This line is a family that was designed so that it could be very broad. The memories and peripherals and central processors are independent of each other, so they can be updated, improved, speeded up, all independently, and we expect this line to go on indefinitely. And then, quite separate from the mini computers, we have our large DEC system 10 computers, which are up with the larger computers and often sell in $500,000 to $2 million price range.
How can you make the distinction between mini computers and full-scale computers or whatever?
There are probably three categories of application. One is where it's just bare, simple hardware. Nothing more than a central processor. Eventually, this will be just all on one chip, and the component manufacturer will have that market. We now have two PDB-11s and a Chevrolet. If those experiments ever work, we'll never sell two PDB-11s for every Chevrolet. They'll have two computers on a chip or several, and that's not our market. That'll be sold by component manufacturers, and they'll cost $5 or $10 a piece. The other application is where people will do all the application work themselves because they're the expert. We can't be expert in the applications. There's just infinite number of applications, and the people who are expert have to apply that expertise. The things which we supply are, besides the central processor, the line of peripherals, the executives to operate the system, the languages, and most of them are very dependent on service. Our service department is the part which is growing the fastest. It tends to be non-proportional to our size, but it's the integral of what we manufacture. And then they're very dependent on training. Last year, we trained 17,000 people at our school. Some of them are in-house people, but most of them are outside people. And this is the large application which we serve. And this is what people need, this whole list of things. Then there's a third category with turnkey operations. We're in a few of these. The number will always be small because a large number of applications are to a large number of fields, and the experts in that field have to really be responsible. A few of those we do are typesetting, for example. We'll go in and do the whole typesetting problem for a newspaper. We'd limit this because we can't be expert in all the things.
In your opinion, Ken, can the mini-computer business support literally dozens or even perhaps as many as 100 manufacturers?
Before the recession, one bank in New York counted 64 people in the mini computer business. But most of them left during the recession. There's a traditional mistake people have made in the computer business. It's a classic, and why people keep making it, I don't know. People always look at something that's in the market and think, hey, I can do better than that. And they can. The thing they forget is the original manufacturer is also working on something better and is a head start. The other trap people get into is they fall in love with the central processor, which is a relatively small part of the system. It really always was. Big part of the cost is the peripherals and the integrating of the systems together. And people fall in love with the central processor probably because every young boy wants to make his own central processor. A central processor, like any other piece of engineering, is a series of compromises. And you make the compromises to optimize the whole range of things you want to work on. And any young engineer will look over the compromises someone else did and think, hey, I can optimize for a particular application, and he often can. And he sells it to his management. Now, the prices are coming down so low that you see less and less of this. And many people who have been in it, for their own use, now have no inclination whatsoever, and they're getting to be fewer and fewer. And as computers are made in a chip, there'll be very few of those who just make central processors. There just won't be any need for them. Students and sometimes professors are caught up with a need for teaching computer science. I feel that there's a limited need for computer science per se. The world will need fewer and fewer central processor designs as we make them in larger quantities at very low prices, and we'll need fewer and fewer compilers, new ones. And so the world needs relatively few pure computer scientists. We need more, an infinite number of people who are good at something and good at computers. But being good at only computers, there's just going to be very little need.
One of the things that has always amused and interested me about Deck is the paperback books, which were proliferated and given away to anyone who would take them at conferences.
Some of them we printed a half million a time and then reprint them, so the number is very large. Free flow of information is just so important, and we came from the academic world, and people wonder how we learned anything about business coming out of the academic world, but we learned a few things. We did some buying there, and we knew that it was just hard to get information.
What do you see as the future for microprogramming in the small computer?
Ken and I are joined by several of his associates. Here's Andy Knowles, who's Deck's vice president of small computers.
The only point I was going to make on the microprogramming issue was if you look at the 11 family, the 1105 is microprogram. The instruction set implementation is because it's the least expensive way to do the job. Now, if you go up through the family machines up to 1140, there's more and more microprogramming employed.
Andy, would you comment on Deck's small computer system software and programming language philosophies?
In the industrial area, most people are Fortran programmers, so that we're trying to make our languages adaptable and interchangeable and upward compatible. In the school areas and what have you, BASIC is very, very popular. In some of the commercial areas, we've got things like our DIBOL and what have you. So we're becoming, in the applications area, pretty much higher-level language and operating systems oriented. And we're encouraging people to go in that direction because we want our machines to be a family so that when a guy writes his program on 1105, we want it to effectively run through the family.
Would you have some comments to make about compatibility across lines? Julius Marcus is responsible for Deck's involvement in the data communications area. Julius?
Well, recently, as these mini-computers became more capable, as they, for example, included high-performance floating-point units, and they became very serious executors of Fortran in both batch and time-sharing modes, people who have invested tremendous amounts of money in applications programs that they've written for other larger machines, for example, find it very desirable to run these on small machines. So we've made attempts to stay within the bounds of industry standards for definitions in BASIC, certain commercial languages, and Fortran, so as to allow people to move freely between machines. This seems to be a relatively important thing to people who work in higher-level languages.
So the higher-level language level of compatibility is what you are presently striving for and achieve.
That's certainly a goal for our software, and our operating systems, of course, are designed to support compilers which are very similar and allow the execution of these application programs in the higher level. But important to us and important to the user is the degree of compatibility that actually can be achieved at the machine language level. And that's important because we now can move our operating systems to a large extent between these families of machines. And that's critical to us as a manufacturer because we would like to be able to upgrade a memory, for example, without obviating the entire system. We'd like to be able to upgrade our central processors in terms of the implementation technique. For example, the degree of microcoding that's used, the type of technology that's used. So therefore, we look for a high degree of code compatibility at the machine language level also.
Andy? There are growing interests in the computer field in the use of stack concepts. And I believe that the PDP-11 has facilities along these lines. Do you feel that software architecture using stack concepts is coming?
We implemented the stack concept for varying reasons on the 11. The use of a stack allows us to implement the interrupt structure that's available on the 11 by storing the given device as it puts up its flag on the stack and then, you know, re-entering nested interrupts. So that the stacks was important to us in that sense. The stacks also we're finding important to us in hardware implementation on later machines, like our floating point implementation on the 1140, is as inexpensive as it is because of the stack capability of the 11. Software-wise, we've used it, and we're using it more internally.
Merits of the stack are that certain very common data movements, usually address movements, are done in a sequence which is natural to the programming sequence, but more automatically through the stack. Julius, the mini-computer has played a major role and is continuing to play a major role in providing interactive and other remote services via telecommunications. Could you give our listeners your views as to how the mini-computer has impacted this area and why?
The inexpensive nature of the cycles that are available from a mini-computer...
Excuse me, you mean... essentially memory storage and access cycles to buffer data, is that right?
Yes, with a mini computer, you can take a relatively small amount of core, a reasonably efficient operating system, and interface it at low cost to lines. Therefore, you find them utilized as remote concentrators in larger applications with large databases, say on the 2314 type of disk offering 20 million bytes of storage per rotating element, they find their way into message switching areas where it's very important to queue large amounts of data in interim storages. Another very important thing about these mini computers in general, almost independent of the data communications market, is that they are used to collect databases in remote areas. Quite often you'll find them used in a cluster concept with multiple terminals associated on it and several people operating, for example, entering data directly on some intermediate storage. And the next desired function to be performed is the movement of that data into a central large database inside of a corporation, so that most of these mini computers are built with data communications capability inherent in them. For example, the 1105 and the 1110 machines which we built have on the central processor boards the ability to interface asynchronous data communications lines. It's just a very natural thing to do, to collect data, reduce it locally, and then move it at lower cost over these lines.
I believe DEC has put out a little pocket book that explains, I found very well, the area of data communications and codes and conversion and so on. Can people get a copy of this if they write someone here?
Oh, yes. We'd be very happy to make these available. They are written by essentially non-technical people who wanted to explain the very basic elements of data communications. And the book is called Introduction to Data Communications. This book can be obtained by simply writing to Digital Equipment Corporation and asking for it by name.
Semiconductor memory has become a growing way of life in the large computer business. How do you see it affecting and eventually replacing the core memory, which has been a standard in the mini-computer business?
We've been using the semiconductor memory in our larger version of the PDP-11, the 1145, for about a year. We have two versions available, which have been popular, especially the MOS version. We went in the 1145 for performance. We offer a bipolar memory at 300 nanosecond cycle and a MOS memory at 450 nanosecond cycle. This pretty much matches the performance of the machine, which I think the large computers are doing. I think the ability of the semiconductor memory to replace cores is in the mini computer area, especially in the 8th and the small and mid-range 11s, is simply a function of when the cost becomes lower than cores. We're making in the order of 200 to 250 million cores a month in the facility that we've started up over the last year. We have another generation of core memory systems on the drawing boards, which in effect lowers the cost per bit, or however you want to measure it again. It'll put more pressure on the semiconductor area. When the costs are lower, we'll use them. And it doesn't mean that the performance has to be the same or higher. We could stand a little bit less performance in the smaller machines than available if the costs were less. But right now we find that at the 8K level, 8K word level, semiconductors aren't quite competitive cost-wise, and hence we're not rushing to them, although we're evaluating them and we're using them and we have memory systems designs available.
In the large computer area, Andy, the greater logical power that's available for the same cost through integrated circuits is being used to produce diagnostic hardware, redundancies of various kinds, so that I've been told that at least one-third of all the circuits in certain large computers are specifically for error detection, error correction. Do you see any of this sort of thing happening in the minicomputer field, Andy?
We see more and more of a move to parity than has been true in the past. We found with the PDP-8 that everybody wanted in a parity memory, as an example, to check for memory errors and what have you, but nobody bought any. I think on the 8i, we must have sold 10 parity memories, and people found that the machines are reliable enough in the 4K word and 8K word and maybe 16K word and maybe up to 32K word machines, that they're reliable enough that memory parity wasn't required and redundancy in the data paths wasn't required. We're finding, though, in the larger memory systems, in the larger machines, such as the 1140, 1145, indeed will require, in the newer generations, memory parity, memory systems with parity, data path redundancy, etc. And we're looking very seriously at it. But I don't think you'll see a strong emphasis on that in our mainline products, the smaller machines. They're just not big enough.
As late as perhaps a year ago, many computer manufacturers commented to me that the cassette recorder type of data storage was not yet reliable enough to depend upon for most applications. Is there any change in this?
We were enthusiastic about the Philips cassette when the first one came out. Now we finally decided that we're happy enough with one we're building to sell it, and we're now producing them and delivering them. It looks like a Philips cassette, but it doesn't have a capstan, which has been the problem we often have in our automobiles, where the capstan ruins the tape or ties the whole thing up in the unit. And it's direct drive right from the hubs. And we use thick tape, I think a mil and a half thick tape, with a layer of plastic on top of the oxide. It's two tracks, and it's relatively simple and non-critical recording. Sacrifices performance for reliability. But we don't claim it'll do high-speed storage, and it's not made for a replacement for a large tape. It's an input device and for simple spooling and collecting of information.
We fully expect people to abuse the purpose for which they were designed. That's been our experience with mini computers since day one. You design them with one particular application in mind, and the very inventive people that use these machines will go off and try to solve much larger problems and much more complex problems, putting an increased strain on them. So we are very reluctant to do very much with these cassettes, because I know, sure as I'm sitting here, that these people are going to go off and design operating systems which involve the insertion and deletion of data in the middle of those tapes. They're going to go off and wrap their business around those cassettes at some point in time and be very, very upset if the data on those happens to be lost, either because of a failure of the cassette or a wearing process in the cassettes themselves. So we're very cautious. We recommend their use primarily as a storage media, an intermediate storage media, but we know that people are trying to try to do some other things with them. Therefore, we've tried to allow for it in the design of the device in the first place.
Perhaps there might come to your mind one or two of the most peculiar applications of mini computers. Andy, you have some comments?
One of our small machines used by the Ferrari pit crews in in the pits at racetracks for timing of Ferraris during races. I'm sure that they're used at Le Mans and what have you. We've got a PDP-8 used by a Dr. Miller in Glastonbury, Connecticut to predict the success or failures of new Broadway shows. We've got several used in production of animated motion pictures. We've got a PDP-8 controlling a potato picker at agricultural school in Scotland. A 12 used for online monitoring of patients undergoing heart transplants. At some city, I'm not sure exactly, there's a walk-in programming service. People can walk in off the street and rent time on a PDP-8 from a dollar up. And then there are varying ones that get more serious, like Chevy Saginaw, where our machines monitor 225 machines and 7 miles of conveyor making breaks.
Many computers have a brave past and an excellent present, and many people see a very bright future. How do you see this future shaping up?
We see the future of many computers just completely bright, and we're just starting. And there's three reasons. First of all, many computers are getting cheaper. This opens up so many applications. We see the price continuing to go down. Secondly, there are more and more people who learn to use them. So many kids are learning to use them in school, and almost all of them students are learning to use them in technical schools. When this generation comes along, you'll see the true revolution in the application of computers. And the third thing, maybe most important, they're fun. And things that are useful, make a contribution to society, and are fun, you can't beat that combination.
With gadgets of any kind, and many computers are no exception, it always helps to get some hands-on experience. So Ken Olson took us to his outer office, where there was a PDP-11, and with the help of his handy keychain screwdriver, he proceeded to take it apart. Please refer to the figures in the notes accompanying the cassette.
The smallest PDP-11 is about 5 1/4 inches high, I would guess. And relay rack size, and Ken has a screwdriver on his keychain to take it apart. We open it up, and there's almost nothing in it. The machine looks to be divided vertically into about two parts, and on the right...
Here's the power supply. It's a unit, comes right out. This is the back panel vertically down the center.
The back panel runs vertically, yes.
And then the modules are about 15 inches long, about 10 inches wide, and they come into the side. And the one on the top you see here is the memory. We make the cores here in Natick and assemble them in Taiwan. And that's the stack you see all in one plane. And then the central processor is one board below it. We have openings on the side here for bringing cables out.
And peripherals.
Peripherals.
Controls.
We have a simple way of tying it to telephone lines.
Now, this particular machine seems to be only about 40% occupied as far as the board positions are concerned, yet there's a full computer capability there?
Oh, yes. That's an 8K memory you see in that one board there. The CPU is two modules, and you have room for adding controllers or peripherals or other equipment.
Oh, what level of circuit integration are you now using? I suppose you're using scale of eights and packaged adders, 4-bit wide, and things like this.
Yes, and then we use quite a few read-only memories. Let's see how we can open the side up here and show you some of those.
Read-only memories for the implementation of the basic instruction set. And most of these chips are about 1,000 bits per package. We see more utilization of chip densities of about 2,000 bits per package.
Now, these are personalized chips for your read-only memory patterns, right? A manufacturer which is making a small pocket calculator has recently hit the Business Week news because of errors in his algorithms. Have you had your share of finding out that there was a bit in error in the read-only memory? Or?
That hasn't been a significant problem, but there's one characteristic of computers which is important for people to know about, and it kind of throws some people, and particularly in some other countries, where the idea of designing something and finding a mistake later on is just beyond their comprehension. nature of computers and the software is such that years later we keep finding things.
PDP-11 is coming apart. There are strip conductors, flat strip conductors, and the plane is 8.5 by 15 with nothing except some capacitors that looks discrete at all. But an awful lot of printed circuit wires. This is single-layer...
Two-sided boards played through holes.
What's the big circuit that looks like it's about 40 pin?
That particular unit is called a UART, a Universal Asynchronous Receiver Transmitter, and it performs most of the functions of serial asynchronous data communications up to about 9,600 bits per second. That's a single chip. That's actually one of our contributions to the industry. We originally developed that chip. It's now, generally speaking, available through multiple sources in the marketplace. We now make a series of multiplexers utilizing that chip, and it's reduced the cost of line interfaces and improved the throughput capability of these mini computers substantially.
For service, all we need to do, I suppose, is take the four screws off and start plugging boards.
Replacements are normally at the board level. It depends on the level of service that the customer has ordered from us, but most of the smaller machines are shipped in and the customer installs them and will send it back to the depot, as we call it, for service after he's tried a board or two. And then we will replace the chips at the board level and repair the machine, turn it around very quickly. The failure rates are very, very low.
I notice that the boards are horizontal. Some of the early machines had vertical boards, as do most large computers, I believe. How do you cool this particular machine, Ken?
You see, we have one fan blowing air in and another fan blowing air out so that we have complete flow of air past the modules and out through the power supplies. So even for a small box, we have two fairly large fans, and this is why we can tolerate such wide range of temperature.
The machine, by the way, Ken, will work with only one of those fans operational over the temperature range, so we put two of them in there.
About how much power does this particular small member of the PDP-11 class take?
About 150 watts.
We use the same power supply in the 8 family and the 11 family, so that we have quite a bit of interchangeability of parts in these machines.
One thing you asked about, which had to do with maintenance, we've taken additional steps recently to improve the ability of individual customers to repair their own machine at the board level through swapping of boards. Our diagnostics are being modified to give more simple, straightforward language indications of failure areas in the machine. What they do is load in a sequential fashion and start with the very elemental portions of the machine, the minimal amount of the machine that need be operational, and they test that particular portion of the machine. They gradually grow to where they are testing. These things are being loaded automatically. They gradually load to where they're testing subassemblies, such as the central processor and the memory. And then finally, we test in an interactive fashion the entire system, including all the peripherals, all the I.O., and all the disks. And we'd like to have the diagnostic indicate, for example, that central processor board number so-and-so has failed. And it turns out that with a high degree of reliability, truth table kinds of analyses and so forth, we can indicate in a straightforward fashion areas where the machine has failed, so that if you have backup equipment, it is possible to repair it in a very short period of time.
So this is the kind of thing, with particularly with two machines, that makes 2 hours a year downtime a possibility.
There's an interesting safety feature here that might be worth pointing out. One time, we had a large computer system burn up. It burned quite thoroughly and was very embarrassing. Now, none of the materials we use here would normally be considered flammable. The boards normally don't burn, but with a large amount of air being blown over them, once a fire starts, almost anything will burn. And so in each of the units, each of the computers and peripherals we put in the system, we have a little thermostat interconnected to the power system, which ties a whole system together. So if anything gets too hot in the system, it will shut down the whole rack of equipment, and that way we avoid any serious fires.
Most of your mini computers today, I presume, have the power-off restart capabilities. Is that standard in many of the lines now, Andy?
It's standard in all the 11s, and it's an optional feature in the PDP-8s for a minimal price, I think, of something like $400, but it's certainly a design feature in all the minis.
This is one of the features of mini computers, I might comment, that makes them usable sitting off in a closet somewhere far away from operators and probably the essential for many of the communication applications. Is that true, Julius?
In addition to the normal power sensing and automatic up-down restart capability of the machine from a power sensing standpoint, we put what are known as watchdog timers in the machines, which actually check the validity of the software, because, of course, the software can be going through loops in the, which are untried and untested, and you may find failures. Now, these watchdogs can cause these machines to restart, and we're working toward the end goal of being able to what we call downline load, or load a remote machine automatically from a central host machine should anything fail in that machine. And as long as the power supply is operational, we are working toward the goal of being able to bring them up essentially with absolutely no intervention from man.
PDP 1105, is it? Is the lowest cost version of a very broad line of machines, the PDP 11 line. And what's the product line concept of the 11 series?
What we did through the history of the PDP 8, I'd be embarrassed to say, except that so many other people have done the same thing. Every time we made a new model, we redesigned everything. And so every new version of the 8, everything changed. On the PDP 11, we have a more obvious concept. Peripherals and the memories and the central processors are all independent. Any memory will fit in any 11, any peripheral will fit in any 11, and any central processor can be used. This way, we can update them separately and independently.
A very specific example of the planning in the series of machines is that the address bus on this machine is 18 bits wide, not 16. And the reasoning behind that is that we wanted to eventually build fairly large versions of these machines and address, you know, 250,000 bytes of core storage. This unibus, which is laying here,
looks like a strip of plastic about 3.5 inches wide to me, but I guess there's some conductors in there.
Right. There are 56 active lines contained in here, along with some grounding lines for shielding and protection. But by simply unplugging this from a very large configuration of memory, which might be external to the box or peripheral, such as disks or communications lines, or the cassette unit that we talked about, you can interchange these central processors over the full line. For example, this 1105 has, say, a performance factor of, let me say, 1. And by successively simply unplugging this unibus and plugging in other central processors, you can upgrade the general system performance to 5 to 7 times that by simply interchanging the central processor. All the other peripherals are operational and valid, and all the other memory subsystems are operational and valid without any change in the software.
Are you managing to fit Grotius' law, that is, the price goes up as the square root of the performance?
The interesting thing about these computers is that they kind of cost per pound. You can weigh these machines.
Excuse me, can I buy 5 ounces worth?
Right. A semiconductor memory board might approach that in its weight. And you'd find that the cost per pound on it was substantially higher than some, perhaps the whole system. But if you, in fact, weigh these computers, you can come up with a reasonable average price per pound on them, or average price per square inch of board, and that's actually a fairly reasonable measure of the cost and the selling price of the machine.
If Mr. Olson doesn't put his thumb on the scale, that is.
Well, people have plotted many items that are manufactured, commodities and sugar and semiconductors, quantity produced versus price on log paper. And they claim everything they plot comes out a straight line. And when we've plotted the price of PDP-8s, the quantity we produced versus the price, it indeed came out a straight line through the years. Every time we do it, we know better. The more we make, the cheaper they are. And the new components are also significant.
You reach the end of this half of your soundings cassette. To continue, stop the cassette recorder, turn the cassette over, and restart the machine.